Accession number 10657, reel 2.
Major Lewis, Reel 2. You mentioned the two officers who greeted you at the B echelon. How old were these two men?
George Blagden had been at Durham School before the war, so it can't be more than he must have been, I suppose, about 21, 22. George Stray, the QM, I would think a little older, 27, 28, I would think, you know.
When you say QM, was he a
quartermaster?
Was he a major?
No, he was lieutenant quartermaster, I think. Or he might have... No, Captain W.G. Stray he ended up as. But he wasn't a major, definitely, no. The quartermaster was not above the rank of captain.
And what about Blagden?
Blagden was a captain. But then he was mad keen on everything to do with motor cars and everything. And he was like I was, but he also knew a little about the technicalities of it all. So he was a good MT officer.
These were both Durham men?
Both Durham men, yes. In fact, most of the battalion was made up of Durham men, but after France, they were all Durhams, I think, in France. After France, they had an intake of KOSB, I think it was. It's in the book, but I think it was KOSBs. And they were a very fine crowd, too. They were a jolly good intake and very soon settled down in the battalion and were very much accepted.
What did you actually do in your time at the B echelon?
B echelon, I was only there for a couple of nights. Just really didn't do anything, just sort of sat around and chatted. I mean, they wanted to know what it was like in England. We wanted to know what it was like in the desert. So there's quite a lot to talk about. But anybody like us coming up, we'd got much later news than they'd probably had in their letters from home. And I think also that it was someone else to talk to, and they liked it.
What were they able to tell you about life in the desert?
Well, they weren't able to, but at that particular time, the battalion hadn't been involved in a lot of action. not a lot, I don't think. I think one or two people had been killed then, but they were really divorced from what was going on in the box. The box was very different to the B echelon. Let's say there was a gap of 8 miles between them. And there wasn't really very much they could tell us about the prime function of the battalion, which, of course, was the patrolling.
You were telling me earlier that you saw a German patrol one day.
Oh, yes, this was at B echelon, where we were sitting out in the open, having our breakfast on a trestle table and sitting on chairs, which was real luxury, really. And it was bacon, eggs and tinned beans and things like that, a super breakfast, you know. And I saw a cloud of dust in the far distance, and I sort of casually said to George Blagden, "What's that?" Oh, he said, "That's probably a German patrol," he said, but he said, "Don't worry about them, they won't come over. They haven't got any time for us, they won't come over this way." And sure enough, they didn't. But that was what the desert was like. You could have two opposing units passing each other within a period of a few miles, possibly. Each one could see the other, but they'd be going in different directions, and they would continue going about what they were doing if they were supply columns. And one has to realize also that the Germans used a lot of captured British vehicles. During one of the breakouts, I think it was Matru, we drove alongside another 3-ton lorry for about 5 minutes before we realized that it got a German driver. And then automatically, we both shot away at a tangent. We went off to the right and he went off to the left, but we'd been riding in a German convoy for a period of time. This sort of thing happened. It was quite remarkable, really.
In the B echelon, roughly how many vehicles were there for the 8th Battalion?
Well, you would have had all of the transport section there. It would have been whatever the transport section consisted of. I suppose, I don't know, maybe about 15 or 20 or something like that. See, the carriers were all up in the box. And if you're talking about specifically the battalion, you're not including the gunner's vehicles or the field ambulance or anything, you're talking about the allocation of battalion transport, which couldn't have been more than I wouldn't have thought about, 15 or 20, something like that.
These were three-tonners, weren't they?
Three-tonners and 1,500-weight trucks. We had a lot of Ford open trucks, which they'd brought down from Iraq. Not 1,500-weight Bedfords or anything like that, but these were American sort of V8 engines, I think, and they were marvellous things for churning around the desert in. And they had picked those up from the 4th Indian Division, I think, in Iraq, before they came up to the desert. In addition to that, we had a certain number of ordinary 1,500 weights.
Did you see any Chevrolet trucks?
They're the ones. They were Chevrolet. But not modern Chevrolets, Indian Army Chevrolets. They were terrific.
What sort of staff was there at B Echelon? How many soldiers did the MTO and the QM have?
Well, just the normal staff that they would have had under any circumstances anywhere. Just a brigade transport officer would have had a transport sergeant and a number of fitters and that sort of thing, maybe a dozen or something like that. The quartermaster would have had his staff as well, not very large. But you see, at that B Echelon, they would have also been within pretty close to the B Echelon for the 74th Field Regiment, the gunners, the 2nd Cheshires, the anti-tank units up in the box, the 149 Field Ambulance and things like that. So really what you got in that B Echelon of the battalion was what normally moved with the battalion. But it was just that it was further away than it would normally be.
You mentioning having breakfast. Who did the cooking?
Oh, that would have been done by the by the quartermasters. I mean, they would have had their own cookhouse in B Echelon. Whether they actually had a cook on the strength, I don't know. Like the battalion had, you know, the battalion had an officer's mess cook, and each company had its cooks. I would think that they probably, they detailed somebody to do the cooking, but they fed extremely well. Tinned peaches and things like that, you know.
Were the vehicles and other things dug in?
Not to the same extent that they were in the box, where everything was underground. Back 8 miles back, they weren't dug in to the same degree, but they were, of course, very well dispersed. That was one of the keys to keeping yourself alive in the desert, was to make sure that your transport was always well dispersed, and that you could easily break it if you needed to. You knew exactly what to do. Every driver had to know. Some kept going in that direction, others shot off to the flanks, others pulled out to the sides. So you had it pretty well dispersed at the echelon.
Did they have camouflage nets over
there? Oh, yes. Yes. I would have thought that if they had time, I mean, quite a lot probably would have been dug in at B Echelon. I can't remember, actually. I do know that the 74th Field Regiment guns were completely underground, covered by massive camouflage nets, really heavy things that took quite a lot of men to sort of manhandle them about. 149 Field Ambulance was underground. That was in the B Echelon. That was underground.
At the B Echelon, did you live under canvas? Did you have tentage too?
No, if I remember rightly, they probably did have tents, but they'd also got dugouts that could be used for sleeping as well. George Blagden, I know, had a dugout, because I remember he got his pictures of his wife propped up in a little cutting that they made in the wall, sort of shelf.
What sort of kit did you have when you arrived?
Well, we would have had the sort of desert issue, which would be shorts and socks and black boots, what have you, a khaki pullover thing, and soft hat, steel helmet, gas mask, probably, I think, and a greatcoat. You needed the greatcoats in the early morning because it was so cold. Could be.
Did you have a personal weapon?
Yes, 3.8, I think it was. I'd have thought, or a 4.5, one or the other, but 3.8.
Now, besides your clothing and your personal weapon, what else did you take with you when you went up to the B echelon?
Knife, fork and spoon, which my... yes, knife, fork and spoon, which I think I'd been given by my father-in-law, actually, which didn't last very long. It I lost it somewhere, rather. But, I mean, we ate out of mess tins like everybody else, you know, and, I mean, in one end of the mess tin you'd have your McConaughey's meat and veg stew, and in the other end you might have tin peaches, and the two of those met, you know, couldn't help it, and that wasn't all that pleasant, but that was the only way. I mean, we all had mugs, I think. Most people had mugs, because tea was the best thirst quencher of all. There was nothing to touch it. And that was really one of the most important things about the whole desert. You had to make sure that half your water ration went into the cookhouse where it was turned into tea. And you got your issues of tea two or three times a day. And even in the blazing hot day, hot tea was still the best thing to drink.
Did you find your uniform and boots comfortable?
I don't... Well, when we first went out there, I suppose... I don't think it... it doesn't ring a bell that I thought that they were uncomfortable, because we fairly soon we got into long khaki drill trousers. I think we had on Sicily. But the battle dress, in actual fact, we did wear battle dress, because we used to buy New Zealand battle dress when we were in Cairo, because it was better material than ours was made from, and a rather darker shade, you know. But I don't think that, I mean, if we did any patrolling, we were issued with what we call brothel creepers, desert boots. They were issued for a patrol and taken in afterwards. So that during the day, we would be wearing boots. I think probably we got around, I don't think we wore shoes, it was boots, either boots or desert boots at night.
Do you remember if the quartermaster at B echelon kept clothing as well as food and ammunition?
Oh, I think he would have done. I don't remember, but I would have thought he would have done, yes. He'd have had a certain amount of clothing there, I think. I mean, we had an issue when we left Geneva, and that's what we went in with. But I would have thought he would have had clothing there.
Did you have spare clothing in your own kit?
I had a valise which had got a certain amount of spare stuff in there, but I suppose shirts and things like that, maybe two or three shirts and underclothes and that, because bear in mind that we very rarely ever got undressed at night. You know, we slept with all our clothes on. We just took our boots off, and certainly at Alamein we didn't get our clothes off for a long, long time. But, I mean, nobody ever got into pyjamas or anything like that that I can remember, you know, and dropped down into their slit trench in pyjamas. No, we carried a few things around in our valises, but you didn't really want too much stuff to carry around, because it had got to be carried somewhere. And if it was going to displace cans of petrol or cans of water, then it wasn't a very good idea to be selfish and carry a lot of kit around with you.
Were there any arrangements for the laundering of clothes?
No. No, you had to... No, there was nothing like that. I forget, in the book, I think we said how much water we had, didn't we?
It was about a gallon a day.
Yes. Water was a half a gallon per man per day, for all purposes. 2 pints went into the company cookhouse. 1 pint stayed in our water bottle. 1 pint was for washing and shaving, and the dirty washing water was filtered and used again. But you know, to have a pint of water slopping around in your water bottle was a temptation. It was an awful thing, actually. The worst thing about the desert, actually, was when you got thirsty, and quite often you did. and you knew very well that whatever you drank, that was it, there was no more. And really it wasn't very much, just a pint a day.
What could you do to ameliorate the effects of thirst if you were suffering?
Well, we didn't have any... well, tea, of course, was issued three times a day from the cookhouse, and that helped. But there was nothing else you could do when you'd had your cup of tea and you'd drunk the water in your water bottle and you'd had a shave and a wash and everything. Really, that was it. But when it got very bad, I think just before we broke out of Gazala, when we had been told that no more petrol was coming up to us, that no more water was coming up and no more food, some of the blokes got absolutely desperate and drank the water out of the radiator of knocked out trucks. Rusty water. It got as bad as that. And there were, I can't remember any names or anything, but there were one or two isolated incidents of people trying to get at water which was kept in the fire trenches and was never to be touched. But it was an unwritten law that you just did not touch that. And 99% of the battalion were well enough disciplined not to. But there was, I think, one occasion in all the weeks we were there where somebody tried to get at it, and I can't remember what happened to him, but he'd have been sent back anyway. You know. But people were pretty good, actually. Pretty good.
You mentioned filtering water.
Yes.
How was it filtered?
Well, I suppose through a cotton thing or something rather like that, you know. I must mention one other thing here. The tremendous importance of having a good sanitary corporal. A combination of the medical officer and the sanitary corporal, making sure that everything was burned and nothing was buried, was the difference between a battalion that was fit and a battalion that wasn't. When we took over from the Maoris at Alamein, the New Zealand division, they had been burying all their refuse. And you walked across the desert, and it was like walking on a cushion. There was all this muck underneath. And I think it took us a week to dig all this up and burn it, because it just wasn't, it was an unwritten law that you didn't do this. In the same way that you didn't, if you ever came across a water, a well anywhere, you didn't poison the well, and neither did the Germans. You know, and it was the same with all this burying of refuse, because the flies were absolutely appalling. I mean, we had an adjutant named Julian Parker, very nice chap. He was with us at Gazala. He was killed at Alamein. But old Julian would sit there, and he reached a stage where he completely ignored the flies. They didn't exist so far as he was concerned. So he would lift a piece of biscuit to his mouth with a fly sitting on the biscuit, and would eat the biscuit, and the fly would still stay there. You know, most of us were doing this all the time, and you've got these swish things with the horse hairs and that. But Julian just didn't bother. So far as he was concerned, if the flies wanted to sit on his piece of biscuit while he ate it, that was it. But they were awful, absolutely awful.
Was the sanitary corporal in the Royal Army Medical Corps?
No, he was in the battalion, actually, and could well be a fighting man if necessary. But as I say, some medical officers were better than others at designing the right sort of contraption to burn everything, and some sanitary corporals were better than others, but they did an absolutely fantastic job. If your sanitary corporal was bad, you got men going down left, right and centre with dysentery, and you'd have a high rate of sickness in the battalion.
So he had to build some sort of incinerator.
That's right, and burn it.
What did you do about latrines?
Latrines were a little, what we used to call desert roses. They were called desert roses. They were long tubular things with like a rose petal at the top, which you urinated into, and they went into a tin in the sand, I think, if I remember rightly. But there again, all that had to be properly controlled. That, I think, probably just disappeared, you know.
So it soaked away.
Yes. But all the big latrines were sited well away from a company headquarters or a platoon headquarters, sometimes in the most awkward positions. I can remember more than one occasion when blokes were caught with their trousers down, sitting on the latrine when an air raid came in or something, and invariably then the rest of the chaps in the company or whatever would be sort of shouting and cheering them on and sort of saying, get your trousers up, get a move on, 50 yards in 5 seconds, and to see if they could make it back to a slit trench because they were quite a long way away from the fire sections.
So you didn't develop the camouflage dug-in latrine?
Not that I can remember. But another interesting point. On a night patrol, if anybody had a weak bladder, he had to be told right at the beginning. In fact, one of the instructions at the beginning of the patrol was, if you're caught short, for God's sake, don't stand up and urinate on the desert, because the sound would carry. You had to lie down on the ground and scoop a hole in the ground and unzip, and that was that, and then you didn't make any noise. Or unfly button, I suppose, in those days.
So this was an important tactical principle.
Very important. All those sort of things were. If you made noise, you were dead. You got to move silently, and everything you did had got to be absolutely quiet. And just that water pouring on the surface of the desert when everything else was quiet could easily carry to an enemy patrol not very far away.
Did you ever come across any wildlife in the desert?
No. They had gazelles up in Iraq, of course. Not wildlife, but the extraordinary thing was the way in which the Arabs used to move around at will between the British and the German lines. There was one occasion, I think I mentioned it in the book, where somebody sent a message back, enemy infantry attacking number one section, and a few minutes later the signal came over again for enemy infantry, please read camels. Because the heat haze made everything look odd. But going back to what I was saying, even if you were in a forward position, you would see coming in from the desert, a group of three or four Arabs, Bedouins, with camels, with their wives maybe, and a few goats, and they would just come right the way through. We used to stop them and search them. But obviously, they knew where we were. They knew where the Germans were. There were quite a few miles between us and the Germans, but they knew the location of each. But you couldn't just sort of lock them all up and put them anywhere. You'd have to feed them and everything. So there was this traffic all the time, backwards and forwards, across no man land, of Arabs. And the other extraordinary thing was that for some uncanny reason, I never saw a camel blown up on a minefield. They are very dainty to the extent that they seem to be able to put their feet where the mine isn't. And they would walk through minefields, the camels, stepping very daintily and not getting blown up. Never saw a camel blown up.
Did anybody in the battalion speak Arabic?
No. Well, the only Arabic we knew were things like Imshi Yalla, you know, and Shofti Bint, and none of which was any good in the desert. Shofti Bint was all right in Cairo and Alexandria. But it was no good at Gazala. No, I don't think anybody did.
Did any of the Arabs ever betray a knowledge of English?
No. I can't remember ever talking to any of them, actually. They just came through the lines and went off to wherever they were going to. I suppose if they'd come back an hour later, we would have been a bit concerned about that and maybe done something about it, you know. I don't think we worried unduly about them.
How did you go forward to the actual battalion box?
Well, that would have been by truck. The actual box, in the box, I mean, it was a brigade box in actual fact. You'd got brigade headquarters, you'd got all three infantry battalions, just give you an idea of the size of it. You'd got the 74th Field Regiment guns, you'd got the 505 Field Company sappers, you've got the Cheshire machine guns, 65th Anti-Tank Regiment, 149 Anti-Tank Regiment, Light ACAC, and 149 Field Ambulance, all in that box. So it was a pretty big complex, actually.
It was a brigade group.
Brigade group. I mean, three battalions alone take up a hell of a lot of space, you know. And it was a complete box. So surrounded by minefields. So you were driven from B Echelon up to the box and to the battalion headquarters, whichever battalion you were going to. From the box, there were tracks leading out to the outposts, Strickland's and Petro's. Petro's, which wasn't used much, Strickland's, which was. That, again, was a truck trip. So you could, in fact, go as far as the most front of the outpost, Strickland's, by wheel transport.
Could you describe the rough shape and layout of the box?
That would be very difficult, but it had got to be a square, in fact. It had to be a square, I think. You know, that's why it was called a box, I think. You'd have had your infantry battalions up in the front and the corners and that sort of thing. You'd have had your 25-pounders back. The anti-tank guns would have been slotted in amongst the infantry. The field ambulance would have been up at the back somewhere, brigade headquarters. The Cheshires were allocated to each battalion had a company of Cheshires with them. And the ACAC, of course, would have been placed wherever it needed to be, around and about the box.
What sort of ACAC was it? Was it Beaufort?
Beaufort. You could always tell chaps who'd been using Beauforts for a long time, and you could always tell the new ones. At Alamein, when the Queens arrived, 44th Division, the Beauforts would be wop, 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 wop. Ours, who'd been at it quite a while, was about half as fast again.
How did they manage to do that?
God knows, but they did. They were just very good at what they did. And the others were new guys to it, and they hadn't sort of run themselves in. But if you heard a slow Beaufort, the odds were that it was a unit that hadn't seen a great deal of action.
When you got to the box, what happened to you then?
Well, I was wheeled in to the commanding officer by George Chambers, who's still alive today, and the commanding officer was a man named Tim Beard. Bearing in mind that the Durham Light Infantry was a very much a county battalion and very much Durham School officers and all that sort of thing. And I don't think they were all that keen to have people from other regiments joining them. Anyway, Colonel Beard looked through my details about myself, and he looked up at George Chambers and he said, "Good God, George," he said, "they're sending us journalists now." But I didn't say anything to that. A few weeks later, I was asked by George Chambers if I would write up a number of citations. The CO wanted me to write up a number of citations for the Ghazala Line actions. And I said, "Well, George, would you like to tell him that I'm only a journalist and I don't know whether I would be able to do that?" He said, "You go and tell him if you want to go straight back to B Echelon." So I did that. Did him a good turn. He was a nice chap, Beard, actually, but he left soon after that, and we had Jake Jackson, who turned out to be an absolutely magnificent CO. Marvellous man.